Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We are going to continue taking testimony on the governor's budget recommendations today. And we're going to begin this morning with John Heterick. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Berglund, committee members. My name is John Heterick. I chair the National Disability Institute in Washington, D.C., and locally serve on the board and executive committee of Opportunity Partners. I think my most important credentials in the disability area, however, are my 32-year-old daughter with a severe developmental disability, and my 35-year-old son with severe learning problems and mental health issues. In my view, there is no better credential than having raised kids with disabilities. My daughter lives on $795 a month from SSI with both Medicare and Medicaid support, as well as SIL supports twice a week and a job coach. She is extremely vulnerable and is able to live semi-independently only with the support of her SILs worker from Episcopal Social Services and her job coach from LifeWorks. We, of course, provide additional support, but won't be here forever. My daughter is very lucky. She has a supplemental deeds trust that owns her condominium, so she pays only $320 a month in condo fees, leaving her $475 a month for all other expenses. But I doubt anyone here would like to try covering all expenses other than housing on $475 a month. Sarah is lucky because she has our support. Most families can't do remotely close to what we can do. The rate cuts that the governor's budget imposes could ultimately eliminate the SILs and job support that keep my daughter living independently. When we're gone, that will remove virtually all the support that she has for independent living. Then what? With minimal supports, Sarah can live independently. Without those supports, she will be dependent on the public, which I simply cannot believe is what the state wants to have happen. I'm also here on behalf of Opportunity Partners and other service providers. OP has been operating since 1953 and serves more than 1,500 people with developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, autism, and other cognitive disabilities every day. In most cases, OP offers day services that provide employment training, employment, and other constructive ways for our clientele to be a positive force in our society. Without these services, where would these people go? Does anybody really believe that by cutting services, our clients will be less of a burden on society? If so, I'm afraid it's simply delusional. The 2.58% cut for fiscal 2009 imposed a $600,000 cost reduction on OP. In response, we eliminated 11 important staff positions through attrition, dropped a long-term company health insurance plan. The inevitable outcome has been that our service quality is being sustained only by the exceptional dedication of our already highly overstressed staff. The lack of a good health care program will ultimately make recruitment extremely difficult, if not impossible. The proposed cuts for fiscal 2010 would drop yet another $600,000 cut on OP. As a member of both the board and of the executive committee, I can assure you that there is no fat at OP. Most of our staff are paid in the $11 to $13 per hour range, and I ask you, in that kind of a budget, what's to cut? The consequence of this additional cut will be to further erode what it has taken OP 57 years to build, and that would be a genuine tragedy. From my board position, I can confidently tell you that these budget reductions could easily be an existential threat to Opportunity Partners and its many disabled clients. Thank you for listening. I urge you to avoid further cuts in these vital programs.
Are there questions? I guess not. Thank you very much, and thank you for the good work you do.
You're welcome. I have copies, if that's appropriate.
Yes, that would be fine if you want to leave them with us. Pam Lunenberg, to be followed by John Cheetah.
Good morning. My name is Pam Lunenberg, and I'm the coordinator for the Minnesota Coalition of Licensed Social Workers. Social workers often say, if you want solutions, ask the people who have the problems. By inviting all of us here today, the public, you are doing this. And Madam Chair and Committee, thank you very much for giving us this chance to talk. Social workers see things in terms of systems and how they work together. The governor's budget does protects K through 12 funding. However, when I sat here in this room yesterday, I heard other witnesses describe, as John just did, the budget cuts to many services. Child welfare, for example, so that children in abusive homes receive fewer services. Cuts to personal care attendant services to disabled children and their families. And cuts to services for adults with mental illness. When those adults are parents, that's a real impact on families. I used to be a teacher, and I know that when children affected by cuts like these go to school, they are not ready to learn. They cannot do their best when there's turmoil in their families at home or they don't have enough to eat. Education and students are affected by the cuts after all. And what about solutions? Social workers urge you to keep exploring and considering all the ways in which Minnesotans are connected whenever you make budget decisions. The individuals and organizations here today can better offer this committee specific solutions and advice. What the social work profession can do is urge you to be tireless in working for justice and fairness in all the financial decisions you will make this session. Another issue that is an example of the way the budget system and the financial system is broken is the issue of the ongoing transfer of monies from licensing boards to the state's general fund. Since 2003, the health licensing boards have paid over $12 million to reduce the state's deficit. These funds were collected and dedicated to protect the public and to regulate the health professions. Of course, we all want answers to Minnesota's structural budget problems, and we urge you, as much as you are able, to include a balanced package of revenue increases as well as budget cuts when you work to balance the budget. Thank you for listening.
Are there any questions? If not, Mr. Cheetah, come on up.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Cheetah, Vice President of Public Affairs and Research at Courage Center. Here to testify to two specific supplemental proposals. One is the continuing care rate cut, and the other is the proposed elimination of rehabilitation therapy for adults in our public programs, medical assistance and Minnesota Care. Courage Center, Madam Chair, as you know, was founded over 80 years ago with a pretty fundamental mission of integrating individuals with disabilities into our broader society. Since that time, we have implemented a number of innovative programs. We were the first in the state to provide camping services for individuals with disabilities. We were very involved in the establishment of the traumatic brain injury waiver in the 80s, and even in the 1950s, were instrumental in establishing the first accessibility provisions in the state building code. I give you that history of innovation and inclusion because we take it very seriously, our commitment and our mission to serve those who are hardest to serve and those who have very little by way of monetary means. We serve 12,000 individuals every year. 35% of those are on medical assistance. The implications for both the rehabilitation therapy cuts and the provider rate cuts have forced us to look very hard as an organization as to how many individuals with medical assistance as their primary funding source we can continue to serve. The proposed rehab therapy cuts for us, it's also a jobs issue. We would eliminate 16 full-time equivalents terms of staff who are providing those services, but for the privilege of serving all of our medical assistance clients, we lose, on average, about $800 per client. So we are now seriously looking at Rule 101, which, as you know, is the state standard. If you are going to accept certain forms of reimbursement payment, such as serving state employees and workers' compensation, you need to meet a certain threshold of clients who carry medical assistance as a funding source. We are now looking at limiting access to individuals with medical assistance as a funding source within legal limits. It's what we have to do. It is what we have to do. Philanthropy cannot continue to underwrite that portion of our loss as an organization that comes from serving medical assistance clients. And we all know what the economy has been over the last few years, and we're very good at fundraising. We raise about $9 million a year to plug that hole that our service and our commitment to our medical assistance clients create. So I'm not here today to tell you specifically where we will begin to limit access for those who carry medical assistance as a funding source. I will tell you that it is going to happen.
Mr. Cheetah, I would caution you to remind your board that the Courage Center does receive a special nursing home rate from the state of Minnesota.
We do, Madam Chair, and a fundamental component of the programming in that program are the rehabilitation services that are being proposed to be eliminated by the governor.
Right, but they haven't been eliminated yet. He proposed eliminating them last year, too.
He did.
But you're telling us regardless you're going to be limiting services to public
I think,
clients.
Madam Chair, we recognize that the levers that government has to cut costs, particularly in this area, are relatively crude, and provider rate cuts among them. Our infrastructure is thin, and you will hear that from a number of other providers that come before you, but even that differential payment is not enough.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Keller, to be followed by Michelle Kimball.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cisa Keller. I am the Director of Government and Community Relations for New Horizon Academy and the Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association represents 250 privately owned child care businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. We care for over 30,000 children every day. Currently, about 20 to 25% of our families we serve receive some sort of child care assistance. I'm here today to let you know that I'm very disappointed in the governor's proposal to cut the child care assistance program in Minnesota, and to tell you that the cuts he is proposing would cause irreversible harm to the integrity of Minnesota's early education system that is already hanging on by the thread. The governor's budget proposal has several cuts to the child care system, but I'm going to focus my testimony on the proposed 5% reduction in the provider reimbursement rate. When he was asked last week whether he had cut early education, he answered no. I'm here to remind everyone that child care is early education. The governor proposes to reduce a provider reimbursement rate that is based on the cost of care in 2001. What other business does the state say in 2011, I want to pay you what the cost you to provide your service is in 2001 minus 5%? Imagine saying to 3M, I will only pay you the cost of scotch tape, what it cost in 2001, minus 5%. Families can go without scotch tape. They cannot go without child care. How can families purchase something in the market for the less than it costs to provide it? I would also like to emphasize here that child care is job creation twice over. Child care employs thousands of teachers, and we provide support to allow working families to work. If New Horizon Academy stops caring for the 1,400 families that currently receive child care assistance in our programs, how many will have to quit their jobs and need significant increases in other assistance from the state? What will that cost Minnesota? New Horizon Academy alone would have to lay off over 400 staff. In 2003, severe cuts were made to the child care assistance program. centers closed, and the system began a slow erosion process that we have not recovered from today. New Horizon alone closed four centers that year as a result of the cuts. High quality child care centers in communities like Richfield, Crystal, Burnsville, and Minneapolis, and we have not been able to return to those communities. And what the governor's proposal does by cutting rates decimates what's left of quality child care in every Minnesota community. If the proposed provider rates are realized, New Horizon Academy will have to close probably 14 centers. And the rest of our locations will probably have to stop taking children that receive child care assistance. And it's not just New Horizon Academy. We surveyed Minnesota Child Care Association members, and 40% said they would no longer serve families utilizing the Minnesota Child Care Assistance families if the provider rate is cut. If we close child care programs and communities, we will not be able to return. As small business owners, the risks are too high that we would be in the same situation, fighting the same battle in the future. Child care providers want to focus on getting kids ready for school and for life, not here fighting for survival every year. Child care providers cannot operate their small businesses this way. And what is frustrating is that the small savings that would be made in the governor's budget proposal would cut rates would destroy the infrastructure that took decades to build and will take decades to replace in communities that need it most. We cannot repair a decimated child care assistance program next year with a new governor or in a few years when the budget improves. The damage done by cutting child care rates will cause immediate and permanent damage to our economy and job loss in our communities by losing small businesses and their best child care providers, and to our children by missing their window of opportunity for their brain to develop to its greatest potential. I know your problem is large, but please find another way. Child care cannot be one of these cuts. Thank you.
Are there questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. Michelle Kimball and Karina Allen. Be followed by Maureen O'Connell, etc.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. If it pleases the Chair, I do have extra copies of testimony that is available to the committee.
All right.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Michelle Kimball. I'm the Senior State Director for AARP here in Minnesota. I'm joined here today by one of our key volunteers, Karina Allen. I'm here to let you know that AARP is very concerned about the governor's proposed cuts that fall disproportionately on health and human services. We are, however, most troubled by the impact these budget cuts could have on elderly and frail nursing home residents if rate reductions and the repeal of rate equalization prevails, as well as what they could do to those who are able to receive long-term care in their homes and communities. To protect these critical services, AARP strongly believes that providers should be adequately paid in order to provide good quality health care, especially in long-term care settings, whether it's in a nursing home or in their community. Home and community-based services in particular have already suffered a rate cut during the last budget negotiations and simply cannot afford any more. Such reductions could end up forcing older residents prematurely into expensive nursing home care, increasing long-term care costs to the state. On average, the medical assistance program can provide home and community-based services to three people for the cost of serving one in a nursing home. Proposed cuts in this area may save a dollar now, but will cost the state significantly more in the long run. As for nursing home residents, our most frail Minnesotans, they could suffer in two ways from the governor's proposed budget. First, we are very concerned that the rate cut to nursing facilities could lead to a reduction in staffing, which will lead to a reduction in the quality of care. Second, to make up for this rate cut, the governor proposes to force nursing home residents who pay their own way to pay more by repealing Minnesota's rate equalization law. This repeal would result in a significant cost shift to residents who pay for their own care out of pocket. By 2014, nursing homes would be able to charge private pay residents whatever they wanted and use it however they wanted without any guarantee of better quality. Not only would such a shift cost individuals thousands of dollars more, but it could also cost the state more. Increasing the daily rate for private pay residents means they spend down faster and become eligible for medical assistance sooner. a fiscal note completed in March of 2006 to address House File 2826 estimated that the repeal of rate equalization would result in a cost to the state in 2009 of $9.1 million. This assumed that the rate increase was only 5%. And while pro-repeal advocates see this as a way to make up for proposed budget cuts, repeal, in fact, does little to ensure fiscal stability, nor does it address the budget issues facing facilities that have more than a majority of MA residents. Opponents will tell you that we're only one of two states with rate equalization. No one else does it. Why should we? We should because it works. We have some of the best quality in the country. Can we do better? Absolutely. But we could also do a lot worse. Minnesota has always been a leader. So I ask you, why should we bring ourselves down to the level of others? They should bring themselves up to our level. AARP urges you to reject repeal of rate equalization and the proposed budget cuts to long-term care providers who are already struggling, and instead find a balanced approach to the budget that allows us to, a minimum, maintain what we currently have until we can work together to address the bigger, more systemic problems in the system through comprehensive long-term care reform. Now I would like you to hear briefly from one of my highly valued volunteers who knows what it was like for nursing home residents before rate equalization and since.
The equalization law was one of the many laws that improved nursing home care in Minnesota. It is my understanding that Minnesota and North Dakota have the highest percentage of good nursing homes in the country. In my second career as a social worker at a clinic out of Hennepin County Medical Center, and later as a social worker part-time in a nursing home, led me to want to make changes in long-term care. The reasons for passing the equalization law were we didn't want a two-tiered healthcare system. It is difficult to get equally good healthcare for both groups when one group pays more. Before equalization, most of the good homes had two lists. If one were a medical assistant patient, most good homes did not have a bed. If one had money, there was a bed. Many medical assistance patients are people from upper and middle classes that have run out of money paying for their health care. It is hard for them and very cruel of us to then force them to have to adjust to poor care. After equalization, the poor homes seemed to disappear, and the good homes multiplied because they were paid as much taking care of medical assistance patients as private pay. A study done a few years ago comparing Minnesota rates with Wisconsin rates have shown Wisconsin, which doesn't have equalization, had rates for private pay patients 40% higher than what Wisconsin paid for medical assistance patients. That will push people into a medical assistance care sooner. Let's not kill some of the laws that have made our nursing homes so good. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for listening to us.
Are there any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony regarding this issue. And I guess I was just going to comment that I believe it was our former Attorney General, Mike Hatch, who worked with hospitals to make sure that people who were uninsured and private pay weren't charged more than people who were paid, you know, with insurance or had payment through some type of a program. And I think the reason for that is because without constraints to try to level the payment field in terms of what's paid, you see, and as insurance rates have risen, you see more and more people in the state without insurance having to pay from their personal assets, and nothing is more true than in long-term care where a lot of people don't have that kind of coverage. And so they're paying a disproportionate amount to try to balance the cost pressures on our nursing homes. And I'm very much sympathize with them, but you have the people who can least afford to pay being charged the most until they can then qualify for a public program, which then just adds to our tax costs. So I think you've just reinforced what we've already expressed here.
I agree completely. In fact, we found that the poor nursing homes, the quality became much, much better. Believe me, there were so many nursing homes that just quit. Quite a few of the nursing homes were built by druggists, and then you'd have to buy your drugs from that pharmacy. And so we got laws to change that. We've done so many things. Senator Berglund, I can't thank you enough for all of the good work that you did in getting in the home health started. This has saved a lot of money for the state. Let's not kill those kind of laws.
Other questions? Thank you both very much. Maureen O'Connell, Boyd Brown, and Ann Quincy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Advocacy Director at the Legal Services Advocacy Project. LSAP represents legal aid clients on public policy issues. And today I have two colleagues with me, one from Legal Aid, the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis, Ann Quincy, and then I have Boyd Brown with me from Goodwill Easter Seals. And we're going to testify primarily about three items in the governor's budget: the elimination of GA, the counting of SSI towards MFIP, and the elimination of Minnesota Care. So I'm going to turn it over to Ann and then Boyd, and then I'll come back and talk about the health care cuts.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Ann Quincy. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. I work in the benefits unit, meaning that I work with families and single adults and help them establish eligibility for benefits like SSI, MFIP, and GA, as well as a host of other public programs. The rules for these programs are very complex. Establishing and then maintaining one's eligibility can take a long time and a lot of paperwork. I work with people every day who will be dramatically impacted by the proposed changes to the human services programs in Minnesota, who will lose their housing, their connection to medical care, their ability to work toward self-sufficiency. Regarding the proposal to eliminate general assistance, the Department of Human Services fact sheets on this proposal don't say so, but let's be clear. Minnesotans receiving our general assistance grant get $203 a month to meet all their basic life expenses except food. That's rent, transportation, clothing, hygiene products. If they're in-group residential housing, GA recipients get a personal needs allowance to meet all those needs, but at least their housing is paid for. So people with no housing support at all get $203. As you can imagine, many are homeless. They're living in shelters, they're staying on someone's couch, or in a garage. A lucky few live in subsidized housing where they pay one-third of their income for rent. In order to get general assistance, a person must show they cannot work and they have almost no assets. Most do this show that they cannot work with a doctor's certification that they're too ill to work. But in fact, many also meet the Social Security definition of disability in that they will not be able to work for at least a year. But the average wait from applying for SSI to being found disabled is more than a year. When they win their SSI case, and we win most of our SSI cases, but so do people with no attorney at all, the system is not very well run. Minnesota gets reimbursed from SSI for all the GA provided in the interim. Most of my clients waiting for SSI are on GA, and they are people like Gary, who was 54 when he applied for SSI. Living with his mother, who was on a fixed income, he used his GA to help contribute to their housing expenses. Gary's developmentally delayed, mentally ill, and hasn't been able to work since his 20s. He can't read or write more than his name. When he came to us, it was primarily for help with all the paperwork for GA and GAMC. Despite Social Security regulations specifying that someone with an IQ as low as Gary's, the low 60s, was disabled, he waited through two appeals and a year and a half before he won his SSI case. With no means of support during that long wait for disability benefits, how would Gary have gotten the bus to the county office or my office or the doctor? Under the proposal to move people like Gary from GAMC to Minnesota Care, how would he have paid a premium? Food stamps helped Gary and his mom buy food, but what about a warm winter coat and hygiene products? There are many, many GA recipients in Minnesota who are not as lucky as Gary to have a mother with a Social Security check coming in. They don't live with a relative or someone who can help support them. Proposing to cut off all means of support to these Minnesotans is just incomprehensible. Regarding the proposal to include a family's SSI recipient's benefits in determining MFIP eligibility dollar for dollar, cutting MFIP assistance to families with disabled children or adults would have a drastic financial impact on these families. Right now, a family of five with one disabled child gets $674 per month of SSI and $697 in MFIP for the other four members of the family. Under the governor's proposal, that family would see an immediate loss of almost one half of their income. They would be reduced to getting $13 in MFIP for the family members who are not disabled. This drastic cut is to the already meager income of this family is certain to increase homelessness and out-of-home placement of children. Counting the SSI income against the MFIP grant also defeats the intentions of the SSI program. If the SSI recipient is a child with severe mental or physical disabilities, the purpose of the SSI grant is to provide for the child's special, complicated medical needs. While the caretaker is the one who receives the payment, the funds come to them as a representative payee. Federal law requires the representative payee to use the SSI payment to meet the disabled child's needs, not the needs of the other children in the family. Directing the parent representative to use the SSI of a disabled child to support the rest of the family, we believe, may violate federal law and will not be allowed by Social Security. They can charge the representative payee with an overpayment and seek the return of the funds. Similarly, the purpose of the SSI program is to provide income to disabled adults who cannot work, not support the other members of the family. The group of families on MFIP that this is targeted at, with a household member or members with disabilities, are the most vulnerable families on MFIP. The legislature recognized this in 2007 when it repealed the provision that required counting up to $125 of their SSI against the MFIP grant. This proposal to now count it dollar for dollar magnifies the pain on families with members with disabilities a hundredfold.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Boyd Brown, and I'm the Director of Employment Services at Goodwill Easter Seals, Minnesota. Today, I'm going to focus on just giving you some insight into the MFIP families we serve that have disabled parents on Social Security who will be impacted by this cash assistance reduction, a dollar-for-dollar cash assistance reduction. Before I go on, I just want to make it clear that Goodwill Easter Seals will see no financial gain or loss due to this MFIP policy change and will continue to provide services for these families. We are here today solely out of the concern for the families we serve. Goodwill Easter Seals is more than the retail store that you shop at or donate to. We are a statewide workforce development agency providing employment-related services to people with barriers to education, employment, and independence. One way we meet this mission is by providing Social Security advocacy services. Through this program, we serve over 300 families per year who need assistance in applying for Social Security, and the majority of these families are on MFIP. Due to the nature of this service, we learn about all facets of these families' lives, their financial, social, emotional, and medical aspects. Today, I'll share insight and knowledge about these families through two stories, Georgia and Tiffany. You may ask, why are they not here today? I think once you hear their stories, you'll understand why. These stories are not outliers, but what we see every day on our jobs. First, Georgia. She's currently a participant in our program in the process for applying for Social Security. 2 years ago, Georgia was married with two children. She's always struggled with depression, but was able to manage her daily responsibilities. She was able to hold a job and care for her children. Her husband left her suddenly, and she spiraled downward into a deep depression. Her diagnosis, major depression, severe recurrent, and anxiety disorder with agoraphobia. So what does that mean for her on a daily basis? She basically doesn't leave her home unless she absolutely must. She leaves her home maybe once per month. Without her sister, most of her daily responsibilities would not be taken care of, including grocery shopping, cleaning her home, running errands, etc. While her children are at school, she spends most of her day in bed. At night, she is unable to sleep due to her racing thoughts and worries. In the past year, due to her financial circumstances, she has been homeless 3 times for several months at a time. She and her children have stayed in shelters and with her sister. As you can imagine, the stress and trauma of homelessness significantly exacerbated her symptoms. The good news is we do fully expect her to get Social Security benefits through our help, which will improve her financial situation, but it will still remain precarious. We have found in many situations like this, when we are able to improve their financial stability, they are likely to engage in mental health treatment and to improve their emotional well-being. However, with this proposed reduction, Georgia may once again end up homeless and continue this cycle of trauma and stress for herself and her children. The next story I'd like to share is Tiffany. Tiffany is a 25-year-old single parent of 3 children. With our assistance, she has secured Social Security benefits for her family. After her 3rd child, she suffered from postpartum depression, which turned into major depression with anxiety. Due to her depression, she has extremely low energy, and she struggles with her daily responsibilities, including getting her older children ready for school, cleaning her home, making meals, shopping, etc. She has struggled for many years to maintain her housing, stable housing for her family, and has experienced several periods of homelessness in the past 3 years. Tiffany's combined MFIP and SSI income barely cover her current expenses. She has rent of $725 a month. She's on a waiting list for Section 8 housing. Utilities, transportation, toiletries, school clothes for her children. Any decrease in her financial resources would add to Tiffany's struggle to meet her monthly obligations and puts her family at a higher risk of once again becoming homeless. So I urge you today to remember Georgia and Tiffany as you continue to deliberate and vote on this proposed MFIP policy change, and thank you.
Hi, I'm just going to briefly talk about the fact that we urge you not to adopt the governor's proposals regarding reducing eligibility and increasing premiums for MinnesotaCare. MinnesotaCare has been a great tool for low-wage workers to do the right thing. And the right thing that society wants low-wage workers to do is to purchase health care coverage. At the time of the greatest recession in recent times, we can't imagine why taking away this product is a good idea. And with the GMC cut, it leaves single adults with very few options. We think at the end of the day, it seems that this is really a concerted effort to gut not only GMC, but to gut MinnesotaCare. As Ian has testified, we know the Garys of the world who, at the end of the day, are the ones that will be eligible for MinnesotaCare, are not going to be able to navigate the MinnesotaCare eligibility and enrollment systems. It seems that we are dooming a program for failure, but by putting people into a program that it was not designed for. We urge the legislature to reject this approach. Thank you.
One of the questions I have is, I understand when you're a representative payee for a child or another family member on Social Security disability, you fill out a monthly form to indicate the allocation of the expenses regarding the Social Security payment. And if you're, for instance, if you're prorating the rent and there's 4 people in the family, you can only take 1/4 of the rent to claim on that expense sheet. And these expense sheets can be requested by Social Security at any time to be reviewed. And so if you had to put more than a quarter of the rent down for an individual as a representative payee, what would happen when that sheet is reviewed by the Social Security Administration?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. The accounting that a representative payee must do, particularly a parent for the child's SSI benefit, is required. Most parents are required to keep that accounting and then report it at least once a year. In other states that have tried directing representative payees, ordering representative payees to use an SSI recipient child's benefits for other children in the household or for the parents' use themselves, Social Security has charged the representative payee with an overpayment. They then try to recover the funds that have been misspent from the representative payee. In Wisconsin, in January, Social Security provided a parent with an advisory opinion to provide to the court so that the parent could explain to the court that the parent could not use the child's SSI benefits for the parent's expenses. Social Security is quite clear about this. It's set out in the Social Security Act and regulations that the representative payee is not to, for the use and benefit of any other household member but the beneficiary.
Are there other questions? Thank you all very much. Lawrence Massa. Be followed by Ms. Shapiro.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing the state's 147 hospitals and 17 healthcare systems. It's extremely difficult to look at the governor's proposed budget and evaluate its impact on the hospital community without knowing if a workable solution to maintain coverage for the people enrolled in general assistance medical care has been achieved. Please know that enactment of a GAMC bill remains MHA's highest priority for this legislative session. We are hopeful that a GAMC veto override is still a possibility. Assuming a worst-case scenario, however, what does it mean to hospitals and GAMC enrollees to be automatically and temporarily enrolled in Minnesota Care? We believe it means less access to appropriate health care for low-income residents already struggling to make ends meet. It also means significant increases in uncompensated care on top of the cuts recommended by the governor in his supplemental budget. First, there's the issue of premiums. This population simply can't afford the premium, and they won't stay enrolled beyond whatever remains of their 6 months of eligibility. The Department of Human Services estimates in its November forecast that less than 22,000 of the 38,000 people enrolled in GAMC will move into Minnesota Care. The department predicted that far fewer people, just slightly over 15,000 individuals who would otherwise be eligible for GAMC, would be enrolled in Minnesota Care in 2011. What will happen to the other 23,000 individuals who were formerly enrolled in GAMC? They will join the rapidly growing ranks of the uninsured. They will depend exclusively on hospitals' emergency rooms for their health care needs. They will lose access to prescription medications, resulting in decreased quality of life, exacerbating public safety concerns in our community, and they will drive up uncompensated care costs, which will ultimately find their way into ever-increasing health insurance premiums. Finally, one of the most important features of the GAMC program is the ability to enroll an individual into the program in the emergency room and being able to get paid at least something for the first incident of care. Minnesota Care will not reimburse providers for services they deliver to people before their applications to the program are signed, sealed, delivered, and processed. We've done some rough calculations and estimate the difference between Senator Berglund's GAMC legislation and the governor's proposal to move this population into Minnesota Care with its current program features could be as much as an $83 million cost to hospitals. And that's on top of the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. and addressing the supplemental recommendations directly, first and foremost, we continue to be disappointed with the elimination of coverage for more individuals in Minnesota. I talked about the 23,000 people that are on GAMC that won't be making it into the Minnesota Care program, but the governor's recommendations call for eliminating coverage for adults, childless adults making more than 75% of the federal poverty guidelines. That move would save the state $129 million, but it will put 21,500 Minnesotans out without health care coverage. It will also increase to uncompensated care to hospitals. It will undoubtedly lead to these folks losing access to primary care and to clinics, and again, increase the use of hospital emergency rooms. We've used a very conservative approach and have estimated that if hospitals receive 26% of Minnesota care payments, the hospital portion of these savings would amount to a $33 million loss in payments. This number could easily be doubled, perhaps even tripled, if Minnesota care enrollees turn to hospital emergency rooms as the sole source of their health care services, or allow their preventable or treatable conditions to languish until emergency or inpatient hospitalization is required. I would turn your attention to the spreadsheet that has been distributed, and that categorizes a number of the budget recommendations made by the governor and directly looks at what the impact to hospital reimbursement will be. And I think the main point that I want to make on that is that two things. It's on top of continuing cuts that we have experienced over the years, putting people out of coverage through various mechanisms, but it's also losing a lot of federal dollars that would otherwise be available to the state. And I want to make the point that for every dollar of state savings, the cost to hospitals is more than another dollar because of the matching situation. Delaying Medicare rebasing saves the state $8.6 million, but it costs hospitals $19.7 million in reimbursements when you consider the lost federal match. Reducing Medicaid and Minnesota Care inpatient rates by 3% saves the state $9 million, but will cost hospitals $19 million. Eliminating the DRG add-on payments saves the state $2 million, but costs our rural hospitals $4.5 million when the federal match is included. Cutting medical education and research costs, the Merck dollar saves the state $21.3 million, but will cost hospitals $44.3 million when lost federal dollars are included. We'd also like to point out that the governor's budget does not directly show how hospitals will be impacted when quarterly disproportionate share hospital payments or DSH payments are eliminated. However, the Department of Human Services currently has a state plan amendment request into the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that includes a proposal to use Minnesota care payments as the leveraging mechanism rather than GAMC patients, and then for the state to keep DSH dollars rather than continuing to make quarterly payments to hospitals as intended. Such a diversion of federal money from its intended purpose to help offset hospitals' uncompensated care and Medicaid losses to propping up the state's funds should be shown in the budget pages as a proposed cut to hospitals, but it is not included. There is certainly a lot of additional information that MHA can provide you in the days ahead to show what these proposed cuts mean to our hospitals and the patients we serve. To put it simply, our options are limited. Additional job losses, additional reduction in hospital services, additional cost shifting to private payers. None of that is something that we would think would be a good idea during a very difficult recession. In closing, I would like to share with you a simple pie chart that illustrates how Governor Pawlenty is once again proposing to solve this budget shortfall by slashing into Minnesota's healthcare systems. And I believe you have that at the table. Of the $825 million in proposed cuts, $347 million would come from cuts to Health and Human Services. That's 42% of the proposed budget cuts. Health and Human Services is only 30% of the entire budget. Cuts need to be made more broadly and proportionately to all areas of state spending, and additional revenues need to be considered as part of the mix. We urge you to work with your colleagues, those who serve on the committee and those who do not, those who participate in your party's caucus and those who do not, and find alternatives to the governor's proposal. A failure to do so will undoubtedly impact access to effective and efficient care for a large number of Minnesotans. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd be happy to try to answer your questions.
President Massa, thank you for coming today to testify. I want to just talk with you a little bit about this chart you brought. I'm glad you brought this chart. It shows $347 million in health and human services cuts. But really, the governor cut $156 million in general fund cuts, and the rest are in Minnesota Care. And then the governor, this doesn't balance a budget.
Right.
This chart doesn't balance a budget. This chart leaves a $387 million hole in the budget. And so, as I see it, if that $387 million isn't included in a budget balancing scenario, we could cut $347 million in health and human services and end up with $387 million later in an allotment in this very budget. And so, you know, we need to be pressing for the legislature to have solved the budget problem by the time we leave here, or else any cut we make, no matter how ingenious we are about it, is still vulnerable to having more cuts on top of it.
Madam Chair, I appreciate those remarks, and I would also argue that the $387 million that the governor is using in anticipated federal money comes from the extension of the FMAP increase that was included in the stimulus bill. And our argument is that money was intended to support healthcare programs like medical assistance and help states offset cuts like the ones the governor is proposing, and to offset the notion of putting more people into the ranks of the uninsured.
Right, and of course it was included in the healthcare bill, which is stalled. It was included in a jobs bill early on, but was removed. So, I mean, I'm a pretty optimistic person. I couldn't keep doing this job if I wasn't, but I don't exactly see this $387 million on the horizon here. I don't. Are there other questions for Mr. Massa? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Massa, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Merck funds. And last evening, a number of us from this division had the opportunity to visit with the Mayo Clinic. And one of the questions that I posed to the clinic was whether or not we are going to choose to continue to support medical education and research in this state. And while I think that those dollars are very well spent and very important in order that we move Minnesota forward, it seems at some point in time, as we continue to experience cuts in that area, there must be a breaking point. There must be a point at which the return on that small investment, you know, does it really go far enough? Does it really, are we really getting anything from that investment? And so I wonder if you can comment on, with these proposed cuts, is it time that we have that policy discussion in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I think that's an excellent point. You know, the Merck funds support medical education in our hospitals throughout the state. It has certainly a larger impact at some of the larger institutions like Mayo, Hennepin County Medical Center, Fairview University Hospital. But Merck dollars also support training of other healthcare professionals that's done in hospitals throughout the state. And Merck dollars do not fully support the cost of medical education in our hospitals. Our hospitals are subsidizing that cost through their margins, essentially, and to keep training strong in Minnesota. And we have a workforce shortage that is looming in the future. And so I think it's very unwise to be making cuts of this nature when we really need to be reinvesting more resources into training healthcare professionals. And I think it puts some programs in jeopardy. Some hospitals will rethink their ability to continue to subsidize medical education in their organizations.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and President Massa.
Thank you for this analysis, the impact on hospitals. It's so critical for us to take a look at this. And these are additional cuts, and I'm recalling the statements you made last year about last year's cut, that it was so critical. Could be compared to a greater meltdown that the hospitals are experiencing than the banks experience. And yet we're back here now looking at additional cuts. I know your organization has some positions on solutions, and I know Senator Coring is interested in hearing those as well. Could you remind us what your organization's recommended solutions are related to the budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, we have been supporters of Senator Berglund's bill. We have worked with legislators and other stakeholders throughout the summer to try to find ways to solve the GAMC issue, which is directly related to the whole budget situation for the state of Minnesota. We believe there are mechanisms to leverage additional federal dollars into the state to help offset some of the state shortfalls. Some of those mechanisms were utilized in the in Senator Berglund's bill, and we supported that, even though there was some disagreement and some lack of uniformity in terms of how it affected our hospitals. We also have engaged a consultant and are working on ideas for further reforms. It's very difficult to implement payment reforms overnight that will change the cost curve for these populations, but we believe it's doable in the long term, and we're committed to trying to find some of those kind of solutions to bring forward in legislatures to come. But in the meantime, we've said we would be willing to take cuts, which was part of the proposals that were out there in both the Senate and the House, and we've offered proposals to raise additional federal dollars without raising taxes in our view.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Shiro, to be followed by Christine Kreisch. I think maybe you want to come up together.
Thank you.
Are neither of these people here?
Hi. Madam Chair?
Hello, my name is Kaylin Shiro, and I am the program manager at Jewish Family and Children's Service for the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program. JFCS is a nonprofit agency that provides many services to the Jewish and non-Jewish community. Basic Sliding Fee Child Care provides access to quality child care programs for parents who are working and or attending school. It is important to know your child is well cared for while you are away. When your child is in quality care, parents have peace of mind, improved access to employment and education, strengthening their self-sufficiency and their ability to provide for their families. Children deserve an excellent start. When they are cared for in a positive environment, they thrive and grow, increasing their ability to learn when they enter kindergarten. With the decreased funds for child care assistance, fewer families will be served, the wait lifts will get longer, and parents will not have the peace of mind that their children are being cared for. They will miss work, no longer being able to provide for their families or be that positive role model for their children so many parents want to be. If parents don't have the ability to pay for good care, children will be left with siblings or neighbors or friends. The important early years to learn will be gone. My fear for providers if payments decrease is that the quality providers will no longer offer their services to BSF families because they can get higher rates from other families, leaving fewer choices for the families we work with. Families may be required to make up the difference, adding additional burdens. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And
hi, my name is Christine Creech, and I am a recipient of the Child Care Assistance Program. I came here today to talk about how important child care assistance is to my family. And I've been writing for days when they asked me to come here, and I thought, I can write as much as I want, but most of it is going to come from my heart. I'm a single parent. I have a daughter that's 3.5 years old, and we fell into the program unexpectedly. It's not something that you start out wanting to be a part of. You want to be self-sufficient, take care of your family, like each and every one of you do, I'm sure. Certain things happened in my life that allowed me to get to a point where I wasn't able to have a job and take care of her. And so I found the program and got on the waiting list, and I thought, what am I going to do if I don't have the ability to work to provide for my family? And they told me when I got on the list that the program waiting list could possibly be years before I could get help. At the time that I signed up, I had been self-employed and in the real estate industry, which I've been in for 12 years. So we kind of all know where that had led, and it was entirely obsolete. There was no money there. So I had to try to shift gears, and doing that from being self-employed, having a 3.5-year-old, and at that time she was 18 months, so not knowing what I'm going to do for childcare. So I found myself having to go to Hennepin County for public services, and that's when they signed me up for the Child Care Assistance Program. Within 2.5 months, I got a letter in the mail that said that I am eligible for the program, which I was overwhelmed with. So those being able to have that program, get signed up for it, and have those benefits available to me has allowed me to work a full-time job, which I otherwise would not be able to do. When I first looked into the cost of childcare, they told me, looking around, it was $268 a week. At that time, my employment would be $400 a week. So I thought, there's no way I can do it without assistance. sorry, I'm a little nervous. the feeling that I had at that time, thinking that how am I going to work and pay for childcare, was overwhelming. I never thought that I would get to that point. But when I got to the top of the list, when I got to the top of the list, I was able to put her into childcare, which now I have a full-time job. I'm able to work, provide for my family, and she goes to a daycare that teaches her everything that she needs to know to be a contributing factor to society. There are so many parents out there that are on the waiting list that don't have the ability to work and provide for their family like I do, and I'm so grateful for the program. I wake up every day, I'm happy for the job that I have. I don't know what I would do without it. I barely make, I make about $1,600 a month for take-home pay. It would be $1,074 a month if I had to pay full childcare. And there's no way I would be able to live, not as a single parent in this society. If I didn't have child care assistance, if you took the program away, I thought about what would happen to me then. We would have to go on some form of public assistance. I have health insurance now. I am able to provide a safe, stable environment for my family. Without it, I just wouldn't be able to do it. So we ask very much that you don't cut any funding for it. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you both very much for being here today. Julie Hawley, to be followed by Tony Carter, Paul, and Julie.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Judy Hawley, and I am a physical therapist, and I'm here to represent the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association, the only professional association representing over 5,000 PTs and PT assistants here in Minnesota. The governor's budget proposal includes cutting out physical therapy in its entirety for medical assistance, GAMC, and Minnesota Care for non-pregnant adults. On behalf of the many people we serve who are on medical assistance, we urge you not to let this happen. The most effective approach to the management of chronic conditions and disabilities is to assist an individual in attaining and maintaining their highest functional level, to understand how to self-manage their condition, and to live as active and productive life as possible in the community. This is a critical element of the state's healthcare reform efforts, and physical therapy is a service that is essential to that outcome. Physical therapy helps individuals live in the most cost-effective community setting, which reduces the long-term expense of institutional living. The average yearly cost of a person with a disability living in a nursing home is $56,900 a year. The average cost for the same person to live in the community is $17,000. The difference is clear. Physical therapy for acute injuries and conditions is also essential in reducing the development of chronic conditions and the costs associated with them. It also reduces the need for medications, costly diagnostic and surgical interventions, and hospitalizations. Each year, physical therapists see thousands of individuals aged 21 to 64 who have suffered spinal cord injuries, strokes, brain injuries, or who have multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and other disabling and medically complex conditions. We understand there is a budget deficit, but cutting physical therapy in its entirety is not the answer. We have worked closely with DHS since 1999 to assure appropriate utilization of services to people under state-funded healthcare programs. We have lifetime thresholds after which we have to get prior authorization. And this system has effectively contained the care of the cost of care while maintaining access to essential services. Minnesotans are willing to cut back in many ways, but cutting physical therapy will have a huge fiscal impact on entities that provide physical therapy services, no doubt causing some of them to close their doors. We can't just be looking at the expense side of the equation when balancing the budget. We actually would be adding to the expense side by decreasing the opportunity of people with medically complex conditions and disabilities to reach their fullest potential and to lead as productive a life as citizens within this state, which is a right they deserve. We're proud of what is happening in Minnesota regarding healthcare reform. And I thank your committee very much for the work that you're doing in this area. It's very futuristic. Minnesota is looked at as being a leader in this area. The central theme of healthcare reform is prevention. Physical therapy is all about prevention. Cutting physical therapy will increase costs today and in the future and will have a huge impact on the quality of life of the people we serve. Please don't let that happen. Thank you.
Are there questions? Thank you very much.
I do have a handout that I'll give. Thank you.
All right. Commissioner Carter, President Fleissner, and Director Ring.
Good morning, Chair Berglund, Senators, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today to speak on behalf of counties. I'm Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, AMC, which represents all 87 counties in Minnesota, and also on behalf of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA, whose director, Keith Carlson, is unable to be here with us today. As you know, counties administer directly or through our contracts many of the state's human services and public health programs. And so many of these changes have a direct impact on county budgets and on county operations. Counties do understand that the state's budget, quite frankly, is in the tank, and so there are many difficult choices before all of us. And we are using, as we have in the past, the following principles to assess the budget and the extent to which it will help or hurt counties to deliver our responsibilities. The principles are: don't destroy the basic safety net for people who are in need. Even in these hard times, don't demolish the social services and public health infrastructure to the point that we will not be able to rebuild it after the economy eventually recovers. Don't make budget decisions that will create worse tails in future years because we've neglected to invest in good evidence-based prevention practices. Don't shift cost to local government, thereby creating more inequity across the state because of our greater need to rely on property taxes. And do use this very difficult economic time to make some courageous changes, policy changes, that may not actually be able to fly during times of greater prosperity. Those are the principles we've used. Counties believe that many parts of the governor's budget violate these principles. The budget appears to be long on short-term solutions and short on new ideas. It contains at least one major assumption that is not a certainty, and that is that $387 million in enhanced FMAP, Federal Medical Assistance Program funds, will be received. And this has not yet been appropriated by the federal government. The budget contains many one-time reductions that will not help us in future years. The budget reduces funding for programs for which there is evidence of cost-effectiveness and improved outcomes. And the governor's budget overall contains disproportionately large reductions for health and human services while holding other parts of the budget harmless. The budget does not include a balance of service reductions and new revenues. So in particular, counties are an objection to the following, and Paul Fleissner and Julie Ring, who are here with me, will elaborate more on these examples. It makes permanent the $22.5 million CCSA unallotment. Likewise, we object to making permanent the unallotment of child support enforcement administrative funds. Ramsey County, for example, earns $3 for every $1 spent. So that puts us further in the hole. It reduces funding for the statewide health improvement plan, which we understand to bear evidence-based promises of outcome improvement, and this by $10 million. It reduces MinnesotaCare eligibility for adults who are making only 75% of the federal poverty level, perhaps $8,000 to $9,000 a year. We object to the budget eliminating general assistance and converting it to a one-time only crisis grant. To reducing or delaying several of the mental health grants, to reductions to child care supports and fund balance, and to continuing care provider rate reductions, which would endanger our ability to care for our elderly and the disabled. In Ramsey County, examples of cuts would include our Lake Owosso facility for the disabled and the Ramsey County Care Facility for the elderly, and our ability to provide for DTH services in the community. Some of these examples, such as the CCSA Child Protection Funds and SHIP, the Statewide Health Improvement Program, will impact counties' work directly. Please also note that the CCSA reduction comes on top of a proposed $125 million reduction to county program aid, and that statewide county program aid covers, or 28% of county program aid dollars are used to support human services programs. Some of the other reductions that I've listed will hurt the public and the community infrastructure that makes it possible for counties to do our jobs. I'll ask other testifiers now or with me today to illustrate and to provide more detail on these reductions and on their effects on county services and residents. But finally, we want to ask the legislature as a whole to consider whether or not health and human services as a part of the budget ought to bear such a large share of the reductions. The societal and economic cost of these reductions will be felt in many other areas, of course, including children who are not ready to learn, to increased law enforcement costs, to overall higher health care costs for employers. So thank you very much, Chair Berglund. If you have no questions at this time, we'll hold our questions for the end. Thank you.
Of your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Paul Fleissner, Director of Community Services for Olmsted County. I'm also here as President of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, AMC and MICA. Commissioner Carter did a great job of describing the many cuts proposed in human services. Let me describe what it means at the community level or using Olmsted County as an example. Like other counties, Olmsted County is not in a situation where we can make easy cuts. As I recently said to Commissioner Ludeman, if the only strategy is to cut, then the question for leaders is becoming which vulnerable populations are going to go unserved. In fact, we're already there in many cases, and you've already heard some testimony to that effect. In Olmsted County, for example, we have 190 adults and children waiting for waivered services who have developmental disabilities. In Olmsted County, we have 275 families working poor families waiting for child care assistance. This will grow under this proposal. We have 70 adults with disabilities who are waiting for employment services. We have seen a 25 to 30% increase in applications for public assistance from just a year ago. Our mental health center is teetering financially, and these kinds of cuts will just make that worse. Last year, I closed a county program that served youth sex offenders. This year, I cut my child care licensing staff in half. I just attended our Heading Home Olmsted meeting, which is our homeless project. We have a growing number of youth that are homeless, and we've run out of funds to serve them. We have street social workers who are indicating we have a whole new group of working poor that are homeless and on the streets. When I look at this budget, the working poor, the disabled, vulnerable adults and kids, in need of protection are in the bullseye. Based on the recent announcement by the governor, our administration is now holding positions open. That's not shocking, but for the first time in my tenure, we're holding child protection positions open. Cutting our county aid, CCSA grants, and funds like health care and child care to the working poor will further erode our safety net, which is beginning to look more and more like a hula hoop. I live in a city with more hotel rooms than Minneapolis because of Mayo Clinic. At least that's what our convention bureau says. We also have large retail restaurant industries. I ask you, how are the working poor and the gals, the folks like we've heard earlier, going to get to work with no health care and no child care, and how is that going to help business? These challenges are not unique to citizens of Olmsted County. Counties are in an impossible situation, can't continue to make up cuts when they are hit simultaneously with program aid cuts, CCSA cuts, grant cuts, and levy limits. I would ask you, please preserve the core safety net for vulnerable populations, and thank you for the work you're doing in this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Julie Ring, and I'm the director of the Local Public Health Association. I'm here today on behalf of the city, county, and tribal public health directors across the state. As the local arm of the state's public health system, we and the people we serve are impacted by many of the proposals in the governor's health and human services budget. Mr. Fleissner and Commissioner Carter both spoke most about the DHS side of the budget, and it's in the interest of time, I'm going to focus only on the Department of Health budget recognizing that there are many cuts on the DHS side that also affect your local public health system. Local public health departments have two broad areas of responsibility in law. One is around health protection, and the other is around health promotion, or what we're now calling health improvement. Our health improvement responsibilities have gained more attention of late as we try to focus on ways to improve the health of Minnesotans as a way of controlling healthcare costs. Therefore, I'd like to emphasize our concern about the governor's proposal to reduce the statewide health improvement program by $10 million in the second year of the grant. These grants have already been awarded to local health departments, and we've ramped up our efforts by hiring or contracting for local staff, assembling our community leadership teams, and providing many sub-grants to schools and local nonprofits in our communities. To pull back the funds that we've already been given in contracts would significantly disrupt our community activity. But I think more importantly to you, the reduction in funding means that we'll not see the health improvement nor the healthcare cost savings envisioned by the legislature when the program was implemented last year. It seems that everyone, including the governor, agrees that the healthcare portion of the state budget is growing at an unsustainable rate. And yet his budget would suggest that you cut one of the core programs aimed at curbing some of this growth. I urge you to consider the long-term impacts of cutting public health prevention funding as you work to solve this budget crisis. We do appreciate that the governor this year did not cut the local public health block grant in his budget proposal. This grant has already been reduced significantly over the past decade. And along with property tax revenues, this grant provides the foundation for funding our local public health system. It's the basis for the other activity I mentioned, our health protection activity, and helped support our response to the H1N1 flu outbreak last fall. I know, and our members know, that we're facing challenging budget times, and everyone has to be a part of the solution. As I think I said to you last year, frankly, it's hard to come before you today and talk about funding for systems and funding for prevention programs that show their effect over the long term. I know you've heard many stories, and I've sat here with you hearing many stories of people who are in immediate crisis, and it's hard to look at the full spectrum of this budget as we hear those stories. All I can ask is that we try to take a balanced approach to the budget this year and look at both prevention and crisis intervention as you have to make these really difficult decisions. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have at this time.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And while Courtney Jordan comes up, I just want to correct something I said earlier because this is on the public record. The governor's general fund cuts are around $100 million. The rest comes from Minnesota Care and TANF that are not general fund programs. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Courtney Jordan, and I'm a member of the Minneapolis State Health Improvement Community Leadership Team. I also chair the SHIP Healthcare Workgroup, which is funded to ensure that clinics and health systems change policy and protocol to prevent obesity. As a practicing cardiologist, I see on a daily basis how obesity and tobacco affect the lives of all of my patients. And I feel if you take only one point away from my presentation today, I'd like you to understand that research shows that upwards of 70 to 85% of chronic disease is preventable by four risk factors: physical activity, nutrition, tobacco, and alcohol. As a member of the Minneapolis SHIP Community Leadership Team, I'm here today to highlight the impact of the government's proposed $10 million cut to the SHIP grant. SHIP is an integral part of healthcare reform that seeks to make policy and system changes to prevent the drivers of chronic disease, obesity, and tobacco use. The SHIP program is being implemented by city, county, and tribal public health departments across Minnesota. In Minneapolis, we're in the midst of implementing a range of activities to create environments conducive to a healthy weight and decrease tobacco use. Some examples include the following: improving physical activity and nutrition policies and practices at 9 PICA Head Start centers, 300 privately owned child care programs, and 15 charter and alternative schools, as well as the Minneapolis Public School District. Improving access to healthy foods by increasing land available for community gardening and improving mechanisms to support productions, distribution, and preservation of local foods. Pursuing voluntary smoke-free policies at 13 Minneapolis Public Housing Authority properties and 7 independently owned properties affecting over 12,000 residents. improving the availability of health foods at 4 convenience stores, which will be a model pilot for improving the quality of foods sold in these venues, piloting healthy vending at 10 Minneapolis parks and recreation centers in preparation for a system-wide policy. And finally, ensuring that clinics, especially those that serve low-income, high-risk patients who are often disproportionately affected by diseases, are consistently assessed for obesity and referred to clinical or community-based programs for healthy eating and physical activity. Cutting funding for this program just as it's getting started would mean delaying or stopping some of these interventions. In addition to reducing the burden of chronic disease, SHIP is designed to control healthcare costs. Maintaining the investment in SHIP is a prudent long-term strategy for managing healthcare costs within the state budget. I also want to draw your attention to the Statewide Health Improvement Program 2010 legislative report just released by the Minneapolis Department of Health. It outlines SHIP's activity in every corner of the state, including Minneapolis. And lastly, as an expectant mother of my second child, I feel fortunate that my expertise as a cardiologist will help me raise a family that appreciates the importance of prevention. And on a daily basis, I have the opportunity to impact the behaviors of the individual patients I see. But you all on this committee have the opportunity to affect policy for future Minnesotans and the lives of those Minnesotans for years to come. So thank you so much for your time and attention today. Any questions?
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jordan, I'm not sure if you can answer it or Ms. Ring can, but it was mentioned that the grants have already been engaged.
Correct.
$10 million of grants have already been engaged.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, Julie Ring again. Yeah, the department has already written contracts with every grantee that lets out the full funding. So we've already been, the grant process already decided how to allocate funding across the state, and the contracts were written for the two-year period in which funding was appropriated. So at this point, the cut would mean rewriting those contracts at a lower dollar amount.
And the money has not been let out then, Madam Chair.
Well, I think some of the money has gone out, but it,
not for year two.
You know, the way the contracts work, they don't give it all out at one time. They give it out on a quarterly basis or something.
Exactly.
I think it would be said that the funding has been obligated to use the, that's my understanding of the appropriate word, but the money is sent out upon invoice, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Sharon?
Does that mean then that at the county level you have contracts that commit you to expenditures based on the assumption that you'll be paid according to the contract?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that's true.
And does that mean that if you have to adjust what you're counting on from the state, that it keeps you obligated at the county level?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I would expect, not having seen the documents themselves, that our contracts are written similar to the way the state contracts are written, that have a clause that would allow us to reduce those contracts if funding becomes unavailable. But I don't know that for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Patrick Rowan. To be followed by Dr. Gesko.
Madam Chair, committee, good morning. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Patrick Rowan. I'm the executive director of Metro Meals on Wheels. We represent 40 Meals on Wheels programs in the Twin Cities area from Rogers to Hastings. Last year and currently we serve 4,000 clients a day. And we use over 14,000 volunteers each year to help deliver meals to the elderly and disabled homebound residents. We have a lot of recurring themes and concerns with other folks in the room here. There's just three points that I want to reiterate from the standpoint of the governor's budget. One is, our program and programs in this room and those that have spoken yesterday, majority of them leverage state dollars with federal money, and community support. We have a tremendous amount of corporate, individual, and community support through small businesses and civic organizations, and not to mention the volunteers that help us deliver and serve our clients. This is a tremendous cost savings to what preventing people from entering into a nursing home, which can cost up to $80,000 a year in a recent MetLife study. By helping people remain living in their own homes, they can remain healthy, happy, and independent. And then also give working families the peace of mind knowing that their parents are taken care of. And the second thing that I wanted to talk about today is an increase in the senior population. We've been experiencing an average of 10% increase in demand for service over the last 3 years. By the year 2050, the senior population in the Twin Cities is expected to double those over the age of 65, and those over the age of 85 is expected to increase by 173%. If we're eliminating funding for programs that make the best use of the dollars, and we're having a hard time meeting demand now, what is it going to be like in the future? Now is the time to invest in the innovation and infrastructure that it takes to serve this increasing population. And the third point I wanted to make, Chair, reiterates your point. Our primary focus right now is working with our national partners to ensure that the FMAP funding remains throughout our biennium. That's $387 million that would go to support not only Meals on Wheels, but other human services that are vital to our community. Right now, we experienced a 2.58% cut last year, and the governor's proposed an additional 2.5% cut for this year. Frankly, that we have programs that are struggling and are concerned about continuing service in that environment. Losing that $387 million that the governor is dependent on, I don't know what our programs would do. I don't know how they would be able to continue service without additional cuts beyond that 2.5%. So that's all I have to say today. Thank you again for your time.
Any questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. Dr. Gesko and maybe Heidi Conrad wants to come up with him.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for welcoming me here today. I am Dr. David Gesko, Dental Director, Senior Vice President for Health Partners Dental Group and Clinics, as well as the Health Partners Dental Plan. We are arguably one of the largest providers in Minnesota of dental care to public program enrollees. As such, the governor's budget recommendation is of grave concern to us. In 2009, we served nearly 19,000 state public program patients at our 16 dental centers. We provide much of that care not too far from here at our Midway Dental Center, a specifically designed dental practice to serve public programs patients with added services and features that address their unique needs. We built Midway especially to serve this population and have focused its operation on effective dental treatment to a diverse population. Midway's population is nearly 100% public programs and is positioned in a geographic area to best meet the needs of those in Greater St. Paul. If Health Partners is cut off from access to critical access funding, this population is positioned to lose access to much-needed care and services. You see, given the realities of cost to provide excellent care, critical access is a much-needed piece of the puzzle in order to allow providers such as us to minimally cover our costs. As the director of Health Partners Dental Group, I keenly understand the need to balance a budget and that everyone must make sacrifices. However, as a healthcare professional myself, my foremost concern must be for the well-being of my patients. Oral health problems cause physical suffering, premature death, disrupt children's education, reduce business productivity, and entail considerable expense to treat advanced diseases. Additionally, if access is disrupted to this population, care will be sought at costly emergency departments where the cost-benefit equation is completely lost. During the last legislative session, we were able to strike that balance and produced a well-crafted reform to our dental public programs. I personally sat down with a number of stakeholders, including the Minnesota Dental Association, other safety net dental providers, and legislators, to hammer out a reform proposal that reduced public programs' dental spending by some $18 million, or approximately 20%. This included innovative concepts such as piloting dental urgent care clinics in emergency rooms and establishing a dental subcommittee under the auspices of DHS to advise the commissioner on how to best target critical access funding. We designed an adult dental benefit, minimally necessary services that reduce the likelihood of use of emergency rooms for acute dental needs. It also included cuts to the bottom lines of safety net dental providers through the line item veto of general assistance medical care and the 5% cut to specialty providers, including dentists. Then the governor chose to unallot as a budget solution. Among the additional cuts was a temporary suspension of the Medicaid portion of the critical access dollars. Critical access dental provider payments enable safety net providers to keep their doors open and to treat people on public programs in a more appropriate clinical setting. It is key to sustaining access for this most vulnerable population. This $6.2 million unallotment struck hard at these critical providers. Now, in the governor's proposed budget, the Medicaid portion of critical access dollars would be eliminated entirely, and the amount available for the Minnesota Care portion would be significantly reduced. The mechanism for reducing these dollars is to reduce the number of dentists who would qualify for the payment. Under the governor's proposal, only certain safety net providers, community clinics that meet specific criteria, federally qualified health centers, and a few others, would be eligible to receive critical access payments. These criteria would eliminate Health Partners Dental Group from receiving any dollars. As the largest critical access provider in the state, this is a serious blow, not only financially, but also to our operations as a partnership with the Health Department of Human Services. Our Midway Dental Center was specifically designed with this population in mind. State public programs already reimburse dentists at far less than their fixed costs. Seeing public programs patients is a financially troubling prospect for any dental provider. Yet our mission is to improve the health of our members, patients, and our community. As such, we are committed to serving this population. Critical access dollars make that tenable. Under this scenario laid out in the governor's budget, we face a decision that could significantly affect access in the metropolitan area. Without the critical access dollars that we have been using to support the losses at our Midway clinic, we are concerned with our ability to keep it open. We are already hearing of problems in the community for state public patients to find dental care. Payment cuts and high needs are causing some providers to turn away from this population. Reducing critical access payments exacerbates that problem. In conclusion, I strongly encourage the legislature to reject the governor's proposal on critical access dollars and to restore the program to its former funding. Specifically, health partners must not be excluded from access to these much-needed funds in order to keep our head above water. It is critical to the ability of state public programs enrolling to access care. Thank you for your attention to my message.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Conrad, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Regents Hospital. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on the impact of the governor's budget proposal on Regents. In addition to providing award-winning care, Regents serves as the safety net hospital in the East Metro. Approximately 55% of our revenues come from government programs, and we provide a disproportionate share of charity care. In 2009, Regions alone provided $18 million, and that's cost, in uncompensated care to over 28,000 patients who came from 85 out of 87 Minnesota counties, western Wisconsin, and other surrounding states. Our uncompensated care costs are increasing at a rate of about 3 to 5% each year. We provide extensive educational programs for future doctors, nurses, and allied health professionals. Our services, including trauma, adult, and the only pediatric trauma hospital in Minnesota, burn, wound, and psychiatric services provide critical care not only to the East Metro, but to the entire state. Once again, the governor's budget proposal disproportionately targets Minnesota hospitals, specifically safety net hospitals, to solve the state's budget deficit. While these cuts are targeted at a few, the impact will be felt by the entire community. Our initial estimate of the recommendations to cut inpatient hospital rates, lower medical education spending, decrease Minnesota care eligibility, and reduce mental health supports and services would have a $6 million negative impact on regions during the upcoming biennium. This is in addition to the $13 million cut during the 2008 legislative session and the estimated $23 million that will be lost due to the elimination of GAMC. Frankly, these cuts are just too much for one hospital to absorb. We are finalizing our contingency planning, and everything continues to be on the table. In response to the past cuts, we've eliminated positions, frozen salaries, and cut back capital expenditures, including our desperately needed investment in a new behavioral health building. We are now looking at cutting back services, including mental health and outpatient services such as cancer treatment, which means that all patients, not just the poor, will be impacted. As we make these decisions, we are committed to ensuring that reductions don't impact care at the bedside and the safety of our workforce. However, cuts of this magnitude are unsustainable, and they will force us to reevaluate who we are: provider for all, trainer of our future doctors, and caretaker for our children. We know that the current budget shortfall means that we all need to be a part of the solution, and we're doing our part. But we're very concerned by the inequity of the cuts. Regions has answered the call to become more accountable for healthcare access, quality, and cost. Programs such as our mental health drug assistance program has not only provided needed prescriptions to patients, but also has lowered emergency room and care and public safety costs. I respectfully request that you consider this as you deliberate the governor's budget proposal and the continued need for a GAMC solution. Furthermore, I urge you to help those in need by protecting Minnesota's safety net from these devastating cuts. I thank you for your time, and we would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there questions? Thank you both very much. Peter Klinghammer, to be followed by Jolene Johnson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pete Klinghammer, and just a correction to the lineup, I am not the public awareness director. I am the director of programs and services for the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity for us to share our concerns regarding the governor's budget proposal and the impacts it will likely have on the nearly 100,000 Minnesotans that live with the effects of a brain injury. Minnesota Department of Health statistics show that every day 34 Minnesotans are hospitalized due to a traumatic brain injury, not to mention injuries sustained through strokes and other acquired conditions. We all know someone who has been affected by a brain injury. Today, any one of us here could experience a fall, be a part of a motor vehicle crash, and become one of the 34 brain injuries that do not discriminate. The Brain Injury Association of Minnesota is a statewide organization devoted to enhancing the quality of life and to bring a promise of a better tomorrow for Minnesotans affected by brain injury. Today, we will share three of our concerns regarding the governor's proposed budget that we oppose. Number one, continuing care provider rate reductions. There's been a great deal of testimony from other individuals and organizations regarding how this particular budget proposal will erode our system of care for those in need of returning to the community or preventing them from returning to institution or from going into institutions. We support their testimony and we oppose these cuts. Number two, 1 year disability waiver growth limits. The governor's proposal calls for further reductions in funding for home and community-based waivers for those in most in need. It will reduce new TBI waivers to six per month statewide beginning July 1 of 2010. without new waivers and the new resources they allow. Individuals with brain injury currently residing in more restrictive settings such as nursing homes, hospitals, and correctional facilities throughout the state will remain institutionalized. Too often we see persons discharged or released from institutions with little or no supports in place. This proposed cut will further eliminate options for individuals who are at high risk for reinstitutionalization. Wilder surveys reflect that over 33% of individuals who are homeless on any given day are brain injured. Further, this particular budget proposal is contrary to legal rulings such as Olmstead that call for least restrictive housing to be available. Thirdly, eliminate adult therapy, physical therapy, occupational and speech therapy coverage in medical assistance and Minnesota Care. The governor's budget proposal calls for the elimination of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy from the medical assistance menu of covered services. The governor's proposal and budget description refers to those persons who need these services as having them paid through Medicare. Per Social Security rules, the disabled individual must wait 2 years to become eligible to apply for Medicare. Often within a very short time after hospitalization, all of the safety net benefits that we all take for granted as caring for us in an emergency are depleted. Health insurance benefits are maxed out, and other forms of insurance quickly disappear. The only option left for many individuals and their families is to pursue public assistance. It takes a very long time for the brain to heal from an injury, and getting back to normal is never a foregone conclusion. The medical community refers to the first 2 years after a brain injury as the prime time for rehabilitation to occur. And this would be the same 2-year window of opportunity that will be lost under the governor's budget proposal. These therapies help individuals learn how to communicate, how to walk, how to eat, and how to use the bathroom once again. By eliminating the very therapies that allow a person to move toward a new normal, the governor's budget proposal may very well assure that the person with a brain injury will not be able to function in as high a degree of self-sufficiency as possible, and it will increase the likelihood of needing the very home and community-based services that are slowly being dissolved. Persons with brain injury have needs, and these needs do not go away because a budget proposal eliminates and reduces benefits. If these budget proposals are adopted, the ability of people to return to their families and community will be determined by what is left. We are all one traumatic catastrophe away from needing these services that are in danger of being cut and eliminated. Needs and costs remain and will be incurred elsewhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
Jolene Johnson, followed by Larry Blair.
Good morning. I am here today to speak to all of you about my personal story. We've heard statistics, we've heard different waivers being cut and programs being cut and reasons why. And the truth is, I am that person. I am the human being that utilizes the majority of those services. Yesterday, I've been going to the Courage Center for about 5 years. And I have limb girdle to a muscular dystrophy. For those of you that do not know about muscular dystrophy, the type that I have, it's a degenerative muscle disorder, and it only gets worse. It does not get better. So for preventative care, I use the Courage Center, and I go to occupational therapy, physical therapy, land, and water, and utilize the pool, which is also good for muscles like your heart. I have utilized the Courage Center since September. I've been on a very concentrated program where I swim on Tuesdays and Thursdays, And on Wednesdays, I have occupational therapy and physical therapy. The reasons why I need these services is because I cannot get out of bed. I cannot get in bed. I cannot get on the toilet. I cannot get off of the toilet. I cannot take a shower by myself. I have to have a personal care attendant. I've had personal care attendants since I was 18 years old. I am 30 now. I am at a nursing home level and don't want to be. We hear the saying that we choose our future. I don't get that choice. But as much as I will try to stand here or sit here and stand up for myself, I will. By you cutting in September when I went to the Courage Center, there's 13 hours a day that I am by myself. I either sleep in my wheelchair, I lay on the floor because I have fallen, or I lay in bed and have to urinate myself because I have 13 hours of being alone. On yesterday when I went to the Courage Center, I was told that I no longer can go there, that my medical insurance in September has maxed out, and I only get six to eight times of physical therapy through medical assistance. Now, since the beginning in September, I was able to make it into bed. Now, I know you probably can't even fathom what that feeling is, but for me to put myself in bed when I want to go to bed was an amazing feeling. The next thing I was going to work on was getting out of bed, which could have possibly been more important. If there is a fire, I will die. If there is a problem, I have to go to the bathroom, I have to urinate myself. Now that was cut for me, and I do not get that back for another year until I get six more times. I may not have another year. I may not have the strength to maintain what I have. Now, because of that cut, I do not have that option. I am begging you to try anything that you can do to realize that there are people out there like me, and there are thousands of us. Now, I want to choose my future, and at 30 years old, I do not want to be in a nursing home. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from Larry Blair, to be followed by Jim Koppel.
Good morning. I'm Larry Blair, and the director of Fountain Centers, and I'm also here to talk about the 5% reduction in funding for consolidated treatment funds for the chemical dependency programs throughout the state. I also am 26 years clean and sober, and so I know the impacts that treatment has on people. I also know the impact untreated addiction has on society. For the past 5 of the 7 years, the funding has been frozen. And although our cost continues to go up as everyone's cost goes up, and with the impacts of untreated addiction on society, the cost on legal fees, court costs, hospital visits, all continues to go up with untreated addiction. With treatment, all those services decreases. The one thing that increases with treated addiction is employment. Employment does go up following treatment. And with these reductions, there will be programs that serves clients that will be closing. And it's the piece that you guys are facing is tremendous. What you guys are going to have to work on is really going to be a challenge for everyone. There are some solutions that I think are out there. There's a current bill out there on a dime a drink. And this, whether it's a tax, a fee, it's really a user fee. If we look at 80% of the alcohol is only consumed by 20% of the population. It's those 20% that uses the other costs to our society. So having that user fee is really just a way of paying for the services that they're using. So that is one of the solutions that is out there. Some other things that we look at is, I know this isn't part of this department, but let's look at corrections. A person spending 1 year in prison costs the same as sending a person to residential treatment 3 to 4 times in 1 year. Most of the people, actually 85% of the people that are in our prisons today are there because of alcohol or drug-related offenses, although only 17% of them gets treatment. So if we can do some changes with that, in looking at that, that will have an impact on providing treatment for people in need. And thank you for hearing me this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Any questions? Okay,
thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Koppel, next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jim Koppel. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, child advocacy organization. And I wanted to speak this morning just to the breadth of cuts to children in the governor's budget. I had 12 areas that I'm not going to speak to all of them, but it cuts across from low-income family supports to children and youth mental health issues to child care assistance. But I did want to highlight just a few things and pass along some statistics that I hope are useful to you as you consider how you're going to handle these cuts or proposed cuts. And I hope you don't, but I know you have realities to face. First, I'd like to pass along the concern over the permanent cut of the $22.5 million unallotment from Children and Community Services Block Grants, which is the primary source of state funds to counties for child welfare and mental health services. Just to note that Minnesota, I'm not sure if we're 50th now, we were 49th just ahead of Ohio, and in the state with the least amount in terms of percent of funding for child welfare services. when that's the case, I think you put the state in a very difficult position of, one, having a very good program operate at county levels to serve the needs of vulnerable children, but also to show any leadership when there's no money in the game. It becomes a federal-county partnership, and the federal government's a long way away. So we have 87 county welfare programs, child welfare programs, all different from one another and concerning in many ways. So secondly, poverty, the continued reallocation of MFIP money. I just wanted to let you know we are, by most accounts, one of the lower states in child poverty in terms of percentages, but we have the highest percent in the country of Asian children in poverty. 24% of Asian children live in poverty, and that's twice the national average. The African-American children in Minnesota, 41% live in poverty. And the concern about this, obviously, besides just the inequity, is when children grow up in poverty, and we have 50,000 children between the ages of 0 and 5 living in poverty, on average, they're 18 months behind developmentally. And the cost of this, children not being ready for school in Minnesota, is over $100 million a year to our K-12 system. So we're going to pay for all these cuts. We're going to pay for reappropriating or not continuing to use MFIP money as it was as it was stated purpose, and will continue to pay it in our K-12 system. And I want to also say that it's ironic that we are cutting these programs from child welfare and anti-poverty programs And at the same time, in the governor's budget, and I don't think it made it through the bonding bill, but I was thinking of the Moose Lake bonding money, where we would have more beds and more and longer sentences for offenders, many of whom are coming right out of this system that we're cutting today. So the future of that facility depends on serving these children. The last thing I want to touch on is child care cuts. I don't think any program this decade, large program, has been cut as much as child care. The number of children it serves, the providers involved, have been devastated. And at last count, I think there were over 20,000 fewer children in child care than there were in 2003 when the cut started. We have lost over, I believe, 1,500 providers. That was, again, a 2006 number, so it's probably much higher. And we can't continue to decimate this system. So I really am concerned about the continued cut. I look and see there's almost 1,000. There'll be over 1,000 families affected by these cuts, eliminated from eligibility. And in addition to the cuts to providers, which does eliminate families as well, because families quit using a system that the providers have to pass along additional costs to them, makes it unaffordable. It's not just a workforce issue. It's a K-12 issue, and I talk about it with children in poverty. Early childhood is their only opportunity to be ready for school. So I hope that these statistics just serve as ammunition. I hope that you're able to avoid many of these devastating cuts to these programs. And I have heard it said that we all have to share in these cuts, but I think that we have disproportionately asked these populations to take the brunt of them. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Steve Larson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the ARC of Minnesota, as well as co-chair for the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. I first want to thank you for not only holding the hearings this week, but also for the vast majority of you attending one or another of our CCD town hall meetings or one of the ARC meetings that were all the way from Bemidji to Winona. I think we had close to 20 town hall meetings. At those town hall meetings, you heard testimony from individuals like Denise Miller, who testified yesterday, and today, just a few speakers ago, Jolene Johnson, sharing their personal stories with you. Today, I'm going to cover just a few areas that have already been talked about and just share a few highlights. We're certainly concerned about the cuts in $30 million being proposed for the SSI MFIP, as well as the provider rate cuts on which several people have testified. In addition, there's been testimony on the waiver caps. And one point I want to make there is that in a few testifiers from now, you'll hear Sue Abderholden going through, I think, a whole page on the budget sheets on mental health grants and other programs that were cut. But also by putting caps on the waiver programs, such as the CADI waiver, which a high percentage of people with mental illness are serviced by the CADI waiver, we're limiting services for people with a mental health diagnosis also. And there's over 15,000 people, and the CADI waiver has been a great tool and a resource for helping to deinstitutionalize individuals with mental illness. We've heard eloquent testimony about the OT, PT, and speech therapy cuts, and we also heard testimony just a few speakers ago about the critical access dental care. And I just want to share one story that I heard at a town hall meeting that was in Winona that Senator Erickson Ropes attended. And that was about a dental practice and a dentist who 70% of his patients were individuals on public programs. He announced at that meeting a month ago that he was cutting back half of his staff because of the cutbacks in dental programs and that he would no longer be taking any new individuals onto his dental caseload. And so the critical access dental care, which was just testified about, And those cuts are going to impact not only Health Partners, which covers all of Minnesota, but individual dentists such as he that are covering dental services in greater Minnesota and make difficult access even more difficult at this point in time. I'm sorry that Senator Corrine isn't here, because now I'd like to just talk about briefly about a few solutions. One, the ARC of Minnesota is committed to the Invest in Minnesota effort. We need to look at new revenues as we look at solutions. But in addition to that, the state has already initiated some activities or is capable of initiating a series of activities that I'm going to list here that could help address those issues, the issues that we encounter. One of these would be regulatory relief, which we hear from a wide variety of people. We need to establish a community-based quality assurance system, and we have a model of that and how that could work. And we need to make it transferred into an accreditation process that we're looking into so that we can cut back on the expenses in licensing and have a system that's based on outcomes. In 2007, the legislature reviewed a report on case management reform. We need to implement that reform. Case management system is broken. It's not working. Caseloads are doubling or tripling in the counties. We do have a model that is proposed, a blueprint in our case management reform report in 2007. We need to accelerate the implementation of that. We need to work to establish health care homes, which was part of our health care legislation passed a couple of years ago. And I just heard a presentation by Dr. Schiff the other evening, and we need to move in that direction as quickly as possible to save in those costs. In addition, we need to redouble our efforts to prevent nursing home and other institutional admissions. We need to accelerate our discharges and work on the rehospitalization, which is one of the drivers of many of our health care expenses. One of the problems that we have in, right now is housing and housing for persons with disability in our aging population. And one of the opportunities we have is to look on how the state is spending money through group residential housing and break down any barriers for persons with disabilities to build equity or have greater control over those dollars. And finally, a couple other final points. We need to implement the self-directed support option 1915J. Which was passed in 2007, which gives a consumer-directed option to individuals on personal care assistance. We need to break down the barriers to the greater use of consumer-directed options, and I have several stories, one of them of a 97-year-old gentleman on the elderly waiver in Bolas, Minnesota, which I think is in Senator Corrine's area, that is staying at home as a result of some very creative programs that we have. We need a state pool for health insurance for direct support professionals, and we need to break down all the administrative barriers and duplication. There's an editorial in the St. Paul Pioneer Press this morning that addresses this issue, and I applaud them for that editorial, but I think we need to go more quickly. If you're a person with disabilities and you're applying for services, what is told to you is available varies greatly from county to county. And whether you have access to service varies greatly from county to county, and we need to eliminate that and maximize the use of the services that are available. So we're willing to partner as we get into the new reality of what our service system is going to look like so that we can strengthen our home and community-based service system. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Larson, that you mentioned the statewide pool for the direct support professionals. Has that been looked into? Was that information included in the long-term care study that we did for statewide pool insurance?
Mm-hmm.
It was, okay.
I'll defer to Madam Chair on that one.
Which doesn't mean that... I think that study was looking at if the state were to take over the cost of providing the insurance, but there would be ways to help create pools for organizations that wanted to purchase it themselves. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Edward Idy. Be followed by Sue Abderholen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I'm sorry we all have to be here. people are not contingency plans. Jolene is a person. I'm here to speak against the governor's supplemental budget. This budget hurts people who cannot afford to be hurt more. In fact, in my opinion, the proposal is not governance. Most of us want to leave places better than we found them. I've worked in the human service field for over 30 years and have always left my employer better than what I found it. Governor's not doing that. He may be leaving, but you all are still going to be here. Reducing caddy waivers from 90 a month to 60 a month hurts people. Making one-third of the total cuts come from reducing the number of people on Minnesota Care due to a change from 225% of poverty to 75% of poverty hurts people. This, linked with the elimination of GAMC, removes people from any type of health care. Do we simply expect these people to disappear? They won't. They'll always require more expensive care. I want to show you a picture of my three-week-old granddaughter. My son and daughter-in-law have good-paying jobs, and they have good health care. And they needed their good health care because my granddaughter was 5 weeks early and spent 2 weeks in the hospital. They're working for a living and are willing to have their taxes raised to help people. In the proposed GAMC bill, we will actually save money by going with a fee-for-service funding mechanism and still provide our most vulnerable people with health care. Uncompensated care is actually a tax on people who have health care. So whether we use new revenues to offset one program or another, people will still pay for it. Now, the good thing is it's going to be paid primarily by people with means. My mother is 93 years old and lives alone. And until this last year, she actually snowblowed her own yard and mowed her own yard. But she doesn't do that anymore. She has great health care. And I think if I have the luxury of living to be 93, I will not have the same health care that my mother has. What does that mean? What does that mean to all of us? If we enact this budget, we wipe out years of progress in keeping people independent. In this budget, the sickest among us will become even more isolated. People will be sicker, and I dare to say, will look at alternatives. One of our neighbors in the condo that I live in, after years of mental health and chemical dependency issues, committed suicide and wasn't found for 3 weeks because he had no connections. That could happen to any one of us. Is that what's slated for us in the future? I hope not. I'm old enough to have taken undergrad economics from Walter Heller at the University of Minnesota. Many of you don't even know who Walter Heller is. Ryan doesn't. And this proposal has no economic foundation at all. It is when we lay people off, and you've heard from many other people today about job loss. There, in fact, is job losses in the supplemental budget. When people aren't employed, they don't pay taxes. They lose their health benefits. Plus, they're collecting unemployment. So it's not only putting less money into the system, it's taking money out that wasn't coming out. Economically, it's a disaster. I want to thank you. I want you to think about a family member that you might have that needs the services that were described today. Jolene didn't know at 17 that she was going to have this issue, nor other people who presented. Yesterday, a woman talked about 30 years of service to people in nursing homes. She could have chosen a different profession, but she didn't because it's part of who she is. I think we start losing part of who people are in the supplemental budget. There is an area. Last session, you passed action to hire 16 SMRT staff with DHS. The SMRT process is to take people who can qualify for MA and actually would save the state money by moving them through the SMRT process. Not one of those 16 has been hired, folks. Not one. And it's been almost a year. We need to fill those positions. I keep hearing the term safety net, and after 30 years in the field of human services, I think it's almost gone. I don't know where it is. I don't know who's providing it. Yesterday, Dr. Sulik testified that it costs $1,000 a day for someone in the state-operated systems program. And the length of stay costs between $16,000 and $20,000. And people with mental health issues often have episodic needs. But $16,000 to $20,000 for an episodic need that we can have prevention services make that not happen, I think that's poor. If we don't get the GAMC bill passed, the Mental Health Legislative Network suggests that we create a 12-month enrollment period for people at or under 75% of poverty. Those folks should not pay premiums or co-pays. They don't have the income to do that. New people eligible for Minnesota Care, for those at 75% of poverty, do not have to be off insurance for 4 months waiting and then enrolled, and they should be enrolled at the time of application. I think the people who you heard testify today, and yesterday people talked about the loss of jobs, I think people would be much happier paying more in taxes than losing their job. I'd like you to consider that. If the governor won't govern, then it is up to you to lead. Lead by getting together and pass a budget that harms the least and adds revenue streams and keeps the so-called safety net in place. You were elected to make tough decisions, and you've got tough decisions to make. Thank you very much for allowing all of us to testify and for being present. It means a great deal for folks that you're all here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ide, I just want to caution people who keep trying to make Minnesota Care work for people on general assistance medical care. Minnesota Care doesn't have the money. And that's why the governor's proposal doesn't do the things you say in enrolling them into Minnesota Care. There would have to be further cuts to Minnesota Care to do the things you're talking about.
Madam Chair, I understand and I agree. We're just looking at if the GAMC bill doesn't pass, we still need to look at options for having them insured somehow, covered somehow. But I understand. I agree.
Thank you. Sue Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I do have a handout. And thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. As you know, NAMI is a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member with a mental illness, so we really understand these issues. 1 in 4 adults and 1 in 10 children have a mental illness severe enough to disrupt their ability to live, learn, or work in our communities. If mental illness was easily seen, say a mark or a huge sore on your face, I think more people would care and would be outraged at the discrimination and lack of resources available. But the fact is, no one really cares about the mental health system until they or a loved one develops a mental illness and needs treatment and supports. And when they need it, regardless of their income level or their politics, you want the most appropriate care when and where you need it. Not even 3 years ago, the Mental Health Initiative passed with bipartisan support and with both the governor and the legislators' support. The mental health community was full of hope that finally the state was going to address the fragility and inadequacies of our mental health system. However, after reading the governor's budget, that hope has kind of turned into despair. Take just a minute to imagine developing a serious mental illness. Your symptoms could be hearing voices, racing thoughts, or a black heavy blanket weighing down on both your mind and your body, which of course makes it difficult to focus, to have the energy to simply carry out daily activities, to keep track of time. You can't work, so you have no income, and you probably lose your health insurance then as well, Without insurance, you can't pay for the medications and treatment that will help you get better. And without income, you lose your housing. If it's a child, they may need treatment that your insurance doesn't pay for. They might be having difficulty in school and at home, and you need help to keep your child safe. The governor's budget pretty much makes sure that you'll fall into a deep hole and never get out. It says, really, that your life doesn't matter. No general assistance for those who have no income and no assets, and many of those recipients live with a mental illness. Applying for Social Security, SSI, is really hard, and it's not unusual to have your application rejected one, two, three, or more times. It's usually not until someone gets help from an attorney that they're able to successfully appeal, and this process can take years. No GAMC for those who have pretty much no income or housing. NAMI's testified before that simply moving people onto Minnesota Care won't work. Your illness prevents you from navigating the complex waters of healthcare applications where you need to be organized, focused, and cognizant of timelines. No Minnesota Care for those above 75% of poverty, so if you have been able to start working again, perhaps part-time because it's too hard to work full-time, you won't qualify for healthcare benefits. There is a large percentage of people in Minnesota Care who take medications to treat mental illness. I was trying to find the data. I know it's somewhere in my office, but I believe it's more than 30%. And without medications, people will not be able to work, and then we're again back to the bottom of that hole. Fewer CADI waivers for those children and adults with mental illnesses who need a significant amount of help to stay in the community, which costs less, of course, than hospitalization. As Ed mentioned, an average stay at the Community Behavioral Health Hospital costs between $16,000 and $20,000 an episode. Cuts to the children and adult mental health grants that could support them as well in the community will be gone. And, of course, people with mental illness were the first to really be cut off of personal care assistance services. There'll be fewer children's case managers due to cuts in the children's case management funds and fewer children's mental health services due to the cut in the CCS block grant. And 16% of those funds are used to provide children's mental health services. There'll be fewer resources to protect children who, without help, will simply need non-existent mental health services in the future. Fewer state-operated programs, kind of the last of the safety net for those without insurance. We don't know if the reduction in funds in the governor's budget come on top of the $15 million they're short of already and on top of the reduction in expenditures from closing Cold Spring. I realize that there are no good choices and not many solutions. We would certainly support increasing the alcohol and cigarette tax, and as you'll see from the things I handed to you, that actually a very high percentage of people with mental illnesses smoke, and so we'd be taxing ourselves. You could look at there would be cost savings if DHS, corrections, and county jails used one giant formulary for medications so that there could perhaps be bulk savings and people wouldn't have to switch medicines when they go from one system to another, which again increases costs. You could look at healthcare homes for people with bipolar disorder who, according to the data I showed you, have very high costs per person. One thing I know for sure is that those empty jails that we've heard about around the state won't be empty if these programs go away. Before I close, I wanted to share Tyler's story. Tyler has bipolar disorder, PTSD, anxiety, and chemical dependency. He wanted to come share his story, but the thought of speaking in front of a group caused way too much anxiety. Tyler experienced some trauma at the age of 5 and began exhibiting symptoms of mental illness at age 13 and was then diagnosed. Due to his anxiety, he was homeschooled. He was stable for several years, was on medication, and even worked 20 hours a week at Target. Around age 18, he stopped taking his medication and replaced them with illegal drugs, really began to self-medicate, marijuana, etc. He went in and out of treatment programs and finally found an outpatient program that works, one that focuses on harm reduction instead of a 12-step program, and that provides at least some mental health treatment. Right now, he's on general assistance and general assistance medical care and would be homeless if not for his friend's couch. He applied for SSI 2 years ago and was denied, but he lost track of time and failed to file the appeal in time. He reapplied. He's been denied twice more. He now has an attorney, and his appeal will be heard next month. But Tyler really doesn't want to be considered disabled. He wants to go back to school and get a job. He has dreams like any other 21-year-old, you know, an apartment, a job, a girlfriend, a cool car. But he's really worried about what will happen if he loses his GA and GAMC. How will he be able to live? How will he be able to pay for his medication? And what could I tell him? not to worry that it would be all right. All I could say is that NAMI would tell his story and the stories of countless others who will be negatively affected by the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you. We're not going to take any more questions. We're just going to try and get a couple more people in who can't come back. We'll take Elaine Keefe and then Jerry Lawler, and we'll add the last two people to the agenda tomorrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here today to give you the perspectives of two organizations that I represent. One is the YMCA, and the other is the United Way. And both organizations are deeply concerned about the governor's proposed cuts to child care assistance. I'll start with the YMCA, which is the largest nonprofit child care provider in the United States. In Minnesota, over 20,000 low-income children who qualify for child care assistance are served in YMCA programs. That assistance allows the parents to have safe, high-quality care for their children so that they can go to work or go to school. The governor's proposal to cut the child care provider rate by 5% will have devastating consequences both for the YMCA and for the families that we serve. We will be forced to consider closing child care centers. We closed several after the 2003 cuts in child care assistance, and we really don't want to have to do it again. We currently have about 2,000 employees statewide in YMCA child care programs, and many of those jobs would be lost if we're forced to close some of our child care centers and reduce hours and staffing in the others. Child care providers simply can't maintain the same level of care on reduced rates. If low-income families don't have access to quality care, we're going to see an increase in children being left alone at home, left in the care of other children, or bounced between emergency options. Many low-income families will be forced to choose between unsafe care options or quitting their jobs to stay home and take care of their children. Three of our metro area centers are located in areas in desperate need of quality child care. More than 90% of the families served in these centers qualify for child care assistance. The governor's proposed cuts will force the YMCA to look at closing these centers, leaving few, if any, options for the parents in need. The reality for many of these families is that they need to have child care that is accessible by public transportation. And if the centers in their communities close, the lack of child care will force these families out of the workforce and into unemployment. The YMCA is a charitable organization. Our policy is that we don't turn anyone away based on ability to pay. And this is true for all of our programs, including child care, even though that's quite expensive. The law allows child care providers to charge families the difference between what our true cost is and what the maximum rate is that's provided by the state under the child care assistance program. But we don't ask families to pay that difference because we know that they can't afford it. Instead, we subsidize our child care programs with charitable contributions that we raise. Even with that, many of our families can't afford to pay the copays that the state sets for them. At the YMCA, we also provide financial assistance to families to help them cover their copay. Low-income families are increasingly under stress, and many of them are asking for assistance from us in record numbers. If you decrease child care assistance funding, essentially you're asking us to make up that difference by raising more charitable contributions, and there's just a limit to how much of that we can do. YMCA volunteers work hard to solicit charitable contributions, but it's increasingly challenging in this economy. And many of our foundation funders, United Way and so forth, are telling us that we have to be prepared for downsizing of future grants because they're in a tough fundraising environment as well. And that leads me to the second organization that I'm speaking on behalf of, and that's United Way. United Way has made early childhood its top priority because that is the surest path to breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty. That's the point where we can really make a difference in kids' lives. Poor children frequently have parents who are young, who are single, and have low levels of education and limited parenting skills. These are the very children who benefit most from having quality child care. And without it, the vast majority of them are not going to be ready for kindergarten, and they will never catch up to their peers. The governor's proposed cuts to child care assistance, especially the reduction in rates paid to child care providers, will make it far less likely that poor children have access to quality child care. So in conclusion, the governor's proposed cuts to child care assistance will inflict, we believe, lasting damage on poor children, and we as a state will be paying for that for many years to come. We know you're in a tough environment. Please do whatever you can to avoid making these cuts. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry Lawler. And then we'll ask James Carlson and Deborah Schlick to talk to our office about rescheduling.
Senator Berglund and committee members, thank you for having me here. My name is Jerry Lauer. I'm the program director of the Dorothy Day Center for Catholic Charities in St. Paul. I am one of, or our facility is one of many facilities in the metro area. Our numbers are such that we have 5,800 people who used our services last year. Of that 5,800 people, 2,500 people slept overnight, and of those 2,500 people, we provided 64,000 units of housing last year, or shelter, I should say. The question was raised earlier as to where folks will come. I think that they'll end up at our door. That's a scary concept because we are at capacity right now. Catholic Charities runs 40 programs that range in emergency services like this as well as through a continuum of housing. You cannot walk into any of our sites and not see the impact of years of cuts to human services. Add the increased need because of the economy, and you quickly understand why programs like the Dorothy Day Center are operating at capacity. We have never had to turn anyone away from our doors because we are operating beyond our capacity, but I come here today to tell you we are at that point. This winter, a collective group of social service providers and the city government in St. Paul patched together a temporary solution so no one was on the streets this winter. But come April, that temporary solution is over. We cannot house any more people at night, and we'll be turning people away at the door. 10 years ago, we started as a seasonal sleeping shelter, housing about 100 folks a night. Over the past 7 years, we've developed into a shelter for every night, and we are at our capacity of 208 any given night. The mats at the floor of the Dorothy Day Center are 6 inches apart, 12 inches between someone's head and someone's foot. Staff cannot walk through the facility without tripping on folks. It's becoming unsafe, and that's why our capacity is such as it is. Historically, we've provided about 450 to 500 meals throughout the day at the Dorothy Day Center. Today, it's more common to serve between 650 and 800 meals. In a survey of our clients, nearly 70% self-identified as having mental health issues. Given the hesitancy for folks to state that, we would expect that to be a higher rate. Some mental illness can be managed through medications, and you've heard that from other folks before. The cost of cutting those programs is going to make that impossible for the folks to care for themselves. Cuts will further strain the already social service system because more people won't be able to go to medical appointments. And all of these cuts ultimately end up stripping folks of any dignity that they have had in their lives. Individually, they're losing resources. Programs that support them are losing resources. And we're talking about folks who have no voice. Persons who will be cut off these programs will fall fully upon the social service system for all their needs. Community, shelter, healthcare as well. It is far more costly, as you've heard throughout the day, to start over with folks than it is to keep them housed, healthy, and working. These cuts are short-sighted. Catholic Charities accesses group residential supportive housing to help house inebriates as well. By doing that, we're able to utilize resources much more efficiently, keeping our police on the street, keeping the detox centers empty, keeping our emergency rooms. If you add those costs up, a tremendous amount of cost that is being saved by working with folks and keeping them in a safe place. Cutting GRH, supplemental, and many of the other budget cuts mentioned here today are short-sighted and financially unsound. I respectfully urge the committee to preserve the fundings of these programs. As I wrap up my part here, I wish to invite you to come down to the Dorothy Day Center any evening and help us provide shelter to the homeless in the heart of St. Paul. We have multiple opportunities, and you can get an eyes on hand or an eyes view of the devastating harm that is being thrust upon those that can absorb these cuts the least. It's not uncommon for me to walk out of my office and have to walk over folks who are struggling with all sorts of issues. And I think that sometimes we end up being detached when we come to places outside that. And I just want to make sure that all of us understand the faces of the folks that we are talking about who will absorb these cuts. It is very saddening to see that and to know that we're going to end up needing to begin to create additional structures and additional resources because the capacity is maxed out at our sites. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, I don't really have a question. I just would like to make a comment, if you wouldn't mind.
I thought about this yesterday, and I'm thinking about today's particularly because this is Catholic Charities, and we've heard testimonies from YWCA representatives in the United Way, Jewish organizations that have come, and I was just thinking that the number of people that are involved in those churches and in supporting YWCA, YMCAs in the United Way, I'm hoping that these organizations are communicating to their contributors, to the members of their religious organizations, what the implications of this budget is, because it is the taxpayers out there that need to start to say we're willing to make contributions, bigger contributions in terms of revenue streams or taxes. And you can help us by using your connections to tell this story and ask the people to understand that they need to be making more contributions to these programs through their taxes. Otherwise, we will not be able to raise revenue, and the only solution we will have will be cuts.
Okay, with that, thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. And the meeting is adjourned.